I want you to try something for me right now. Doesn't really matter where you are. I just want you to reach out and knock on the nearest solid object. Maybe it's the desk in front of you, or the arm of your chair, or even the steering wheel if you're driving. Go ahead, just give it a rap.
Right, and it makes a sound. It feels hard. It physically resists your hand.
Exactly. It feels undeniably real. You would bet your life that the object is, you know, physically there, occupying space, whether you happen to be looking at it or not. I mean, it is the most basic assumption we have about our existence, right? That we live in a material world made of physical stuff.
It's the absolute bedrock of common sense. If we can't agree that the table is made of wood and atoms, what can we even agree on?
But today, we're going to take a sledgehammer to that bedrock. We're looking at a philosophy that argues, with some surprisingly tight logic, that matter, like physical matter, simply does not exist. The chair, the car, the ground beneath your feet, none of it is material.
And we aren't talking about a sci-fi simulation or some Matrix scenario here, though there are definitely parallels we can get into. We are diving into the mind of George Berkeley. He was an 18th century British philosopher and bishop who argued for something called metaphysical idealism.
Right. And to guide us through this completely mind-bending territory, we're unpacking a really fascinating lecture series by Dr. Arthur Holmes from Wheaton College. And Holmes does this incredible job of showing us that Berkeley wasn't just some lunatic. He argues that Berkeley was actually trying to save reality, not destroy it.
That is a crucial distinction. Berkeley defines idealism as the view that all that exists is the nature of the mind or immaterial spirit. But he wasn't just doing this to be edgy or provocative. As Holmes points out, he had a very specific mission.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we need to figure out today. Why would a practical man, a guy who actually ran a diocese and tried to build colleges, spend his whole life arguing that the physical world is a total myth? Mm. And the scariest part is, can we actually use the logic of his time to prove him wrong?
It is much harder than you might think. When you really drill down into his arguments, the whole common sense view of the world starts to look, well, a little shaky.
So let's start with the man himself, because when I hear a bishop who thinks the world is imaginary, I immediately picture this hermit living in a cave, totally detached from the real world.
And that is the very first misconception that Dr. Holmes clears up for us. Berkeley was very much a man of affairs. He wasn't isolated at all. He was a bishop in the Anglican Church in Ireland, and he was an activist. He was deeply, deeply involved in the social and political issues of the 18th century.
He even tried to start a college, right? Like a physical school.
He did. It was called the Bermuda Project. He wanted to establish a college in Bermuda for American Indians. And he spent years lobbying for it. He gathered all this political support and even moved his family to Rhode Island just to prepare for it.
And it failed. And the reason it failed is, I mean, it's kind of hilarious given his whole philosophy.
Yeah. It's deeply ironic. Holmes points out that the project collapsed partly because of financing, which, you know, is common enough, but also because of a massive practical oversight. Berkeley chose a location in Bermuda that literally had no natural water supply.
Okay, we have to pause on that. The guy who goes around saying matter doesn't exist just forgot that human bodies need physical water to survive.
It does suggest a certain detachment from the nitty-gritty details of survival, doesn't it? They would have been entirely dependent on rainwater catchments. It would have been a complete logistical nightmare.
So he's this big-picture thinker who just totally misses the details.
Exactly. And after the Bermuda dream collapsed, he settled in Newport, Rhode Island for a while. You can actually still tour his house there today. Holmes mentions that the local historical society will happily tell you all about Berkeley's vegetable garden.
A vegetable garden for a man who doesn't believe vegetables are made of matter. I love it. But, okay, we have to talk about the tar water phase, because this was the part of the research that honestly made me stop and reread my notes.
It is bizarre. Later in his life, Berkeley became absolutely obsessed with the medicinal properties of tar water, which is literally just water that has been infused with pine tar.
Which sounds completely disgusting.
Oh, it probably was awful. But Berkeley wrote a whole treatise on it called Siris. He believed it was a panacea, you know, a cure-all. He thought it could cure smallpox, digestive issues, pretty much anything that ailed the human body.
And Holmes brings up a really interesting, slightly gossipy psychoanalytic theory here from a writer named J.O. Wisdom.
Yes. J.O. Wisdom wrote a book called The Unconscious Origins of Berkeley's Philosophy, and he basically tries to connect this tar water obsession directly to the idealism. His theory is that Berkeley had a pathological aversion to dirt and excretion.
So he was basically a germaphobe before anyone even knew what germs were.
Essentially, yeah. Wisdom argues that Berkeley saw the physical world matter itself as messy or dirty. So the tar water was this literal way to cleanse the body of physical corruption. And his
It's
philosophy.
a way to cleanse the entire universe.
Exactly. If you can prove that matter doesn't actually exist, you've effectively scrubbed the universe clean. There's no dirt, no mess, just pure, clean spirit and ideas.
That is a wild theory. Like, he hated dirt so much, he just decided to delete the physical universe using philosophy.
It is. Now, Holmes does warn us to take that with several pinches of salt. It's highly speculative Freudian psychoanalysis, but it does help us see Berkeley as this incredibly complex character who is constantly trying to purify our understanding of existence. However, we really shouldn't get too hung up on his psychology because his real motivation was theological. He was fighting a culture war.
Let's unpack that, because in the 18th century, you have the Enlightenment happening. Science is just exploding. Why did Berkeley feel the urgent need to go to war with the concept of matter?
The enemy, at least in Berkeley's eyes, was the rise of materialism and deism. And the root cause of this was, ironically enough, Sir Isaac Newton.
Newton. But I always thought Newton was a super religious guy.
He was very religious, but his physics created a massive theological problem for the time. Newton described the universe as a giant machine. He asserted the independent reality of absolute space, absolute time, absolute force, and absolute matter.
Right.
He viewed the universe as a clockwork mechanism that just ran on fixed mathematical laws.
I see exactly where this is going. Because if the universe is a perfect clock.
You don't need a clockmaker to constantly manage it. You might need a creator to wind it up at the very beginning, which is deism, right? But once it's running, God becomes entirely superfluous. He's just an absentee landlord.
And then if you take it just one step further, you get full-blown atheism. The clock has always been there. It's governed by physics, so no maker is required at all.
Precisely. Berkeley looked at Newtonian physics and saw a slippery slope leading straight to atheism. He realized that as long as we admit that matter is a real, independent substance that obeys its own laws, God gets pushed completely out of the picture.
So Berkeley comes up with this radical strategy. He basically decides, if I can prove that the clock, the actual matter itself, doesn't exist, then the materialists have absolutely nothing to stand on.
It's a scorched earth tactic. He wants to pull the rug out from under them entirely. If matter is a myth, then the universe cannot run on its own mechanical laws. It would constantly require a sustainer, a mind.
Okay, so that's the why. But now we have to get into the how, because this is where the deep dive gets really tricky. I can understand wanting matter to not exist for theological reasons, but how do you actually argue against the table I just knocked on?
Berkeley is incredibly clever here. He basically uses the stones to destroy the stones. He adopts the tools of empiricism, which is the very scientific, observation-based philosophy championed by people like John Locke, to prove that matter is fake.
So he uses the exact logic of the scientists against them.
Exactly. And it starts with a direct attack on language. Specifically, he attacks a concept John Locke called abstract ideas.
Break this down for us, because we use abstract words in English all the time. Motion, extension, color.
Right. Locke believed that the human mind has this unique power to abstract. He said that we can see a red ball, a blue car, and a green leaf, and our mind can then strip away the specific details, the redness, the roundness, and form a general abstract idea of motion or extension, which just means size or space in general.
And that sounds totally reasonable. I can think about the concept of motion without thinking about a specific car driving down the street.
Well, Berkeley stops you right there. He says, no, you actually can't. He challenges the reader to try it. So let's try it right now. Close your eyes.
Okay, my eyes are closed.
I want you to visualize motion. Not a moving ball, not a person running, just pure motion itself. Can you see movement that isn't fast or slow, that isn't going left, right, up, or down?
Man, no. My brain just keeps trying to put a ball in there.
Mm.
Or an arrow. I really can't picture motion without a thing moving.
That is Berkeley's entire point. He is what philosophers call a nominalist. He argues that we only ever perceive particulars. We don't perceive motion. We perceive a moving body. We don't perceive color in general. We perceive a specific red shirt or a blue sky. Even with the idea of a centaur, he says he can imagine a man with two heads or a fairy giraffe because those are constructed from particulars, but he cannot imagine an abstract concept distinct from a body.
Okay, so I can't visualize the abstract concept. But I can still use the word in a sentence, right?
You can use the word, sure. But Berkeley argues it's just a convenient label for a group of particular experiences. It doesn't refer to an actual abstract thing that exists out there on its own.
But why does this even matter? Why is he splitting hairs about whether I can imagine a generic abstract triangle?
Because he springs a trap. He takes this exact logic and applies it to the word matter.
Yeah.
Locke himself admitted that matter was this invisible, unknown substratum. He literally called it something I know not what. He believed that behind the red color and the round shape of an apple, there was this invisible stuff called matter holding all those qualities together.
And Berkeley just asks, can you imagine this matter?
Exactly. If you strip away the color, the shape, the hardness, the smell, what is actually left?
Nothing.
Precisely. If matter has no qualities of its own, if it's just this invisible coat rack that holds the sensory qualities, then it is impossible to perceive and impossible to imagine. Berkeley argues that matter is a fundamentally meaningless term. It's an empty word we use to trick ourselves into thinking there's something invisible underneath the things we actually see.
Wow. So he's dismantled the language. He's basically saying, you guys are arguing for the independent existence of something you can't see, touch, or even imagine.
But he goes even deeper than that. He doesn't just attack the word, he attacks the way we perceive reality itself. And this brings us to a huge part of Dr. Holmes' lecture, the famous distinction between primary and secondary qualities.
This is the part that always trips people up in philosophy. Let's make sure we really get this right.
So in Berkeley's time, the standard scientific view, which was Locke's view and Newton's view, was that the physical world has two types of qualities. First, you have your secondary qualities. These are things like color, taste, sound, heat.
And Locke said these are subjective, right? They depend on the observer. They exist in the mind.
Correct. Think about the heat in a fire. The fire isn't sitting there feeling hot. The fire is just releasing energy. The sensation of heat is something your brain creates when that energy hits your nerves. If you leave the room, the fire is still burning, but the sensation of heat completely stops.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. The pain of a burn isn't actually inside the fire.
Right. But then Locke said there are also primary qualities. These are things like size, shape, motion, and solidity. And he believed these are completely objective. They exist in the object itself. The table is square, regardless of whether anyone is looking at it.
So Locke basically splits the world in half. Color is in my head, but shape is in the object.
And Berkeley says that is utter nonsense. He collapses the distinction entirely. He argues that primary qualities, like shape, are just as subjective and mental as secondary ones, like color.
But how does he prove that? A square is just a square.
Is it? Berkeley uses two brilliant arguments here. First, the connection argument. Try to visualize a shape without a color.
We're back to the visualization test. If I try to imagine a square, it has to be like a black outline on white paper or a solid red block. If I take away the color, I literally can't see the shape.
Exactly. You cannot perceive or imagine shape without color, or at least some kind of visual contrast. So if the color is in your mind, which Locke already admitted it is, and the shape is completely inseparable from the color, then the shape must be in your mind too. You can't have a mental color magically painted onto a physical shape.
Man, that is annoyingly logical.
And then he uses what Holmes calls the castle argument to really drive the final nail in. This is the argument from relativity.
Walk us through the castle.
Imagine you are looking at a castle from 3 miles away. What shape do you see?
From that far away, it's probably just a small, roundish blob on the horizon. Maybe a little point for a tower.
Okay. Now you walk all the way up to the front gate and look straight up. What shape is it now?
It's a massive, towering, flat stone wall. It's square. It's jagged.
So which shape is the real shape of the castle? The small round blob or the huge square tower?
Well, common sense says the close-up one is the real one. The distance view is just a perspective trick.
But why? Berkeley asks, by what objective standard do you judge that? If you look at that same stone wall through a microscope, the shape changes again. If you look at it from an airplane, it changes again. Berkeley argues that the size and the shape change entirely based on the viewer's position.
Just like a bucket of room temperature water feels warm to a cold hand and cold to a warm hand.
Exactly. If the shape changes depending on who is looking and where they are standing, then shape is relative. It is a perception. It is not a fixed absolute property of some invisible object.
So if color is in the mind and shape is in the mind and size is in the mind,
there is nothing left out there. We have arrived at full idealism, es est percipi. To be is to be perceived. The only things that truly exist are minds, which do the perceiving, and ideas, which are what is perceived.
Okay, I have to play the skeptic here. Because as incredibly logical as this sounds step by step, My brain is just screaming no. And I know I'm not the only one. Holmes tells that great story about Dr. Samuel Johnson, the famous essayist and dictionary writer. When he heard this theory, he didn't write a philosophical counterargument. He just got mad.
Yes. The famous I refute it thus moment.
Right. Johnson is talking to his biographer, Boswell, and he just kicks a large stone as hard as he can. His foot bounces off. He feels the sheer pain of it. And he yells, I refute it thus.
He really thought he had won the argument right there. He thought the solidity, the physical resistance, and the pain proved definitively that the rock was material stuff.
And honestly, I'm totally with Johnson on this. If I kick a rock, it hurts. That rock is real.
But Holmes points out that Berkeley would have just smiled at that. He wouldn't be fazed by Dr. Johnson at all.
Why not? Johnson just proved the rock is solid.
Because Berkeley never said the rock doesn't exist. This is the absolute biggest misunderstanding of idealism. He doesn't say the world is a hallucination. He would say, Dr. Johnson, you had a visual idea of a rock. Then you moved your foot and had a tactile idea of resistance. Then you had a sensory idea of pain. Those are all completely real experiences, but they are ideas in your mind.
The pain is real. The rock is real. But they're made of mental stuff, not matter stuff.
Exactly. He isn't denying the reality of the experience at all. He is just denying the existence of an invisible, unthinking substance called matter that's supposedly causing it.
Okay, but this leads right into the big problem, the control problem.
Right.
If the world is just ideas in my head, why can't I control them? Because if I close my eyes and imagine a dragon, I can make it pink. I can make it dance. Mm-hmm. I am the god of that idea. But when I open my eyes and look at this desk, I can't turn it into marshmallows. It's stubborn. It resists me. If it's all in my mind, why am I not in charge?
This is Berkeley's checkmate. This is exactly where he springs the final trap on the atheists. He agrees with you completely. He says, you are absolutely right. There is a massive difference between imagination and sense perception.
Imagination is voluntary. Perception is involuntary.
Exactly. You don't choose to see the room when you open your eyes. That visual data is forced upon you. You don't choose to feel the pain when you kick the rock.
So if my mind isn't causing these ideas, who is?
Well, just look at the logic we've built. Ideas are mental things. You can't get a mental idea out of a dead, unthinking physical rock. Only a mind can create an idea. So if your mind isn't causing the reality you see, there must be another, infinitely greater mind causing it.
God.
Berkeley argues that the reason the world is consistent, the reason you and I both see the exact same castle, the reason the rock hurts every single time you kick it, is because the supreme mind is projecting these ideas to us constantly.
That is a massive shift from Newton. Newton's God built the clock and just walked away. Berkeley's God is streaming the universe to us.
It creates a universe of constant, intimate communication. The physical world isn't a dead machine anymore. It's a language. God is speaking the universe to us moment by moment. When you look at a tree, you aren't seeing autonomous wood and leaves. You are receiving a direct visual communication from the divine mind.
It really does pull the rug out from under the materialists.
Right.
You can't say God is superfluous if God is the literal medium in which we live and perceive everything.
And notice how brilliantly he solved the problem of matter by making it entirely dependent on God. He turned the ultimate threat of science, which was observation and empiricism, into a waterproof proof for theism. He forces the materialist into a really tight corner. Either the world is a chaotic hallucination, or it is the product of a coordinating active mind.
So let's zoom out and look at the big picture here. We started with a guy trying to cure diseases with tar water, and we ended up with a universe that is basically an ongoing conversation between the human mind and God.
It is quite a journey.
But why should you, listening to this deep dive today, care about 18th century metaphysical idealism? It's elegant, sure, but is it just a philosophical parlor trick?
I don't think so at all. I think it forces us to deeply question our most basic assumptions about reality. We live in a hyper-materialist age. We just assume real means touchable. We look for physical causes for absolutely everything, you know, neurons, atoms, particles.
And Berkeley reminds us that our access to the world is entirely mediated through our minds.
Precisely. You have never actually touched an atom. You've never touched a force like gravity. You have only experienced the mental sensation of them. We are, in a very real sense, locked inside the cabinet of our own consciousness.
You know, it really reminds me of modern simulation theory.
It is the exact same underlying logic. Think about it. If we were living in a computer simulation, the code itself isn't material. There is no physical spoon in the Matrix. There is only the code for the spoon.
But if I eat this steak in the Matrix, it still tastes juicy.
Right. For Berkeley, there is no spoon made of independent matter. There is only God's idea of the spoon being directly communicated to your mind. The mechanics are different, God versus a supercomputer, but the ultimate outcome is the exact same. Reality is information. It's experience, not stuff.
That actually makes it so much easier to grasp. We aren't navigating a physical obstacle course. We are navigating a data stream.
And that data stream fundamentally requires a streamer.
So on that note, here's a final thought to mess with your head just a little bit more before you go. We all know the old riddle. If a tree falls in the forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound?
A classic. It's actually the ultimate Berkeley puzzle.
Because if you ask a modern physicist, they talk about sound waves and air pressure displacement. But if you ask Berkeley,
he would say that if there are no ears to hear it, there is no sound as a sensory experience. Sound is the experience of hearing. So no, it doesn't make a sound in that sense.
But does the tree disappear?
No. And this is where people always get Berkeley wrong. The tree doesn't just vanish into nothingness because no human happens to be looking at it.
Because the tree exists as an idea, and ideas need a mind to hold them.
Exactly. So if no human is in the forest, the tree still stands, and it still falls. Why? Because it is being perceived by the eternal mind.
The tree makes a sound because God is always listening.
Touché.
It makes you wonder, does the universe exist only because it is being witnessed? And if so, are we ever truly alone? Something to chew on while you go about your material day.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive into George Berkeley.
It has been an absolute pleasure.
We'll catch you in the next one.